This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
It's 11 minutes past the hour of 11 o'clock. And now it's time for us to have a conversation that I believe is very, very sensitive, emotive, triggering. And for that, I apologize, but some things can't be avoided. As I said to you yesterday, when we were just going through some of the data on the latest crime statistics and also looking at the outcome of a court case involving the Orlando Pirates footballer on domestic violence, many callers came through. They had either an experience of it, a view of it, a concern about it. And it also happened that many men who were going through a divorce sort of linked those two issues together, which I appreciate in the context. But I think South Africa has a violence problem regardless of people's marital status. And what do I mean by it? Love Life wrote a report that said that when we look at the prevalence of violence in South Africa, murder rates in South Africa, assaults with the intention to do grievous bodily harm, the highest proportion of victims of violence are South African men. Okay? So yes, we do talk a lot about gender-based violence and we substitute the G for women. But actually, there is a lot of male-on-male violence that's got nothing to do with a relationship that they may or may not have. So there's just a way in which altercations, disputes, conflict is resolved violently in South Africa. When we talk about things like the proliferation of weapons and guns, how crimes, even just the theft of a cell phone, sometimes involves a gun. So this thing that emboldens a criminal to cause harm because they have access to a gun. So the proliferation of weapons adds to the levels of violence we are talking about. And then, of course, there's the domestication of violence. Man against woman, husband against wife, sister and brother, even parents unto their children. And so, yes, families aren't perfect and we're going to fight in the family for sure. But why are conflicts resolved violently? Why can't you just walk out of a room until you cool down? So there is something in the South African psyche that has violence as a recourse. And a lot has been written about it in terms of the historicity of the problem, the violence of the apartheid system, the normalization of violence, state-sponsored violence in that era, and how that almost carried over into a democratic era. So there is the context. But what is happening almost 30 years after that democracy, where it seems to be a problem that's escalating? What are these burdens we are bearing on our souls that just means we don't use our words, we don't negotiate an outcome, we fight our way through an outcome? So last Friday, the police minister, Begitele, shared the latest quarterly crime statistics covering July and September, and he reported on a staggering 6,945 murders, deaths, lives lost during that period. 881 were women, and 293 of these 6,945 were children. So again, it reiterates this point that the majority of people who die at the hand of a knife, a fist, a weapon, are men. But there is a substantial amount of women as well who are dying. There's also 35 police officers in this time who died on and off duty, and 19 law enforcement officials. And in most of the incidents, when you go into the details, what was going on that led to these deaths and murders? The granular details show that the tragic incidents can be attributed to arguments, road rage, provocation, vigilantism, mob justice. Those seem to have been the causes of deaths, violent deaths in South Africa just in the last quarter. And so today I want us to talk about this. And I want us also to focus on domestic violence, the violence we see in the home. And I'm not saying only husband against wife, partner and partner. I'm just saying in the home, even what children witness and what children can even be subjugated to. Guguletu Khesha is a researcher with the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation. And Guguletu, I'm not sure. Resha Khesha.
Yes, you have it perfectly. It's Resha.
Okay. As I saw it, I thought, I must use my EQ here. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you for coming through. So this picture I'm painting, just by interpreting some of the stats in the last quarter on violent crimes in the country, generally what we see concerning domestic violence in the country, and yes, the component of gender-based violence. Is it true South Africa is a very violent country?
Definitely, Nandu. I think we have quite a strong sense of you know, how abnormal our violence rates are in the country. I think through comparisons with other countries, through the lived experiences of ordinary South Africans, you know, a lot of people, as you're saying, who are calling in, and that you might engage, you know, at any given point in time, can attest to having, you know, witnessed some kind of violent crime or have been a victim of some kind of violent crime in their life. So the stats are everywhere, but I think in the stories that we know and that we live through, we can attest to the fact that there definitely is something wrong at proportional levels.
Okay. And obviously, a lot of people, when they try to get to the root causes, they take us through the historicity of the problem. You know, broken families by the apartheid system, men who can't raise their children because of Dompas laws. They work in the city. The mother and the children are left. They don't see each other for years on end. I understand that historical context and also state-sponsored violence, that we had this apartheid force where anything and everything was resolved by gunfire, police Casper, and we saw massacres from Sharpeville to Soweto. You know, I get it. But is that the sole reason why South Africans have a problem with violence?
I mean, it's definitely a major contributing factor, right? The history, the socio-political, the socio-cultural factors in our history, and how those have shaped, you know, present-day relations in the household. But there's so many reasons, right? It's really hard to pinpoint them. Mm-hmm. And I think the really important thing about, you know, contextualizing the history versus other factors is that they can co-intend, right? They can be layered in the way that they shape and the way that they influence psyches, the way that they influence behaviors, and in turn, what is normalized. So I think one of the things that's really interesting about, you know, how much role does history play and how much is, you know, current day issues, how much is, you know, the current political situation or the current social situations contributing, is the idea that, you know, violence is reproduced, right? It's a socially reproduced phenomenon. So the messaging that is around, that is available around, you know, how was conflict resolved back in the day? What were the things that were effective modes of, you know, of winning a fight, of winning a struggle, whether it's at the political scale, whether it's at the personal scale? There's this recurring narrative that we use violence, that in the past we have used violence, and that is the way that, you know, things are done. So this messaging is reproduced in the public sphere. It's reproduced in, you know, the private sphere, in the homes. And this is why you see this, you know, intergenerational sort of trend where, you know, even young people are becoming increasingly violent as well. And we're seeing this play out in our schools because this messaging is being perpetuated everywhere.
Okay. So there's quite a few things that I'd like to raise. So let's get through them quickly. Culture. You know, some cultures almost romanticize violence. And I'll speak about my own, okay? I am Zulu, right. And there is this stereotype that Zulu people are just inherently violent because we all have the Shaka complex in us. We're warriors. It's in the stories. It's in the chants. You know, it's who we are. But does that also contribute to a normalization of violence in our cultures, in our socialization?
Absolutely. I think absolutely. Culture has such a massive role, right, in terms of what kind of behaviors are permissible or what kind of behaviors are even required of us in order to gain respect, in order to maintain our honor. And I think, you know, when people, the thing about, you know, tying identities to behaviors is that people want to belong. People want to entrench that I am of a particular group. I am Zulu. Mm-hmm. I am a proud Zulu person. I am maybe, you know, a proud man. Mm-hmm. And some of these cultures perpetuate, you know, notions of personal identity that could be, that could be previously seen as noble and as brave, as, you know, this is, these are the people who are worthy of respect. Yeah. So even in the ways that, you know, notions of masculinity are constructed through culture, we see that this has a huge role in terms of, you know, what does a provider look like? What does, you know, a fearless person look like? And there's this pressure to uphold this, this cultural identity and worthiness.
And I think a modern incantation of it, and I want to be careful what I'm saying, I don't want to offend, but also the fact that so many of our political leaders come from the struggle, even that terminology, the struggle, it was a fight. And when they talk about we were in the trenches, in exile, in Tanzania, in Zambia, and MK. So even now, in terms of the modern discourse and the conceptualization of what leadership looks like, it's it's language we constantly hear. Freedom fighters. Has that added?
Definitely. I think definitely there's this, you know, the that perpetuation again of this identity that is seen as noble of, you know, this is what heroes look like. They're the people who fought. They're the people who were fearless. This kind of bravado that is created and perpetuated. And I think it's quite interesting because, you know, our history is not just, even though we had freedom fighters and people fighting for freedom, in a very literal sense, that's, we all know that that's not the only way that, you know, freedom was attained. A lot of it was also negotiation. A lot of it was coming together to the table to resolve conflict. And I think a lot of that is deliberately left out and much to our to our detriment, right? Because that was the make or break, the negotiation part.
So we've got context in different parts of our history. Pre-colonial, colonial, apartheid, democracy, that sort of elevate the image of violence is what I'm hearing you say. And now... let's talk about the social conditions, from poverty to unemployment, to just stress, anxiety, modern day living, even load shedding. To what extent do these add to people's propensity for violence? And I want to talk about things that we're seeing now, the road rage, the vigilantism. To what extent are the conditions of the modern day, of 2023, really making people a little bit more on edge?
I think, you know, the modern sort of challenges that, that South Africans are facing in terms of the economic situation, in terms of the political situation, the uncertainty, the constant state of, you know, of precarity for a lot of South Africans, I think has a very clear impact on our emotional states, this continuous state of alertness, of anxiousness. And so when people are in states like that, right, and you've got people also living from paycheck to paycheck, this kind of constant state of alertness can have people really agitated. It can have you really agitated in the absence of, you know, healthy modes of resolving conflict, of approaching conflict. It's easy for people to, at the slightest of triggers, you know, sort of resort to violence, and we see that in different spaces, right, in different areas. And I think once you have other aggravating factors, such as, you know, crime, such as, you know, people using substances, right, to cope with all of these daily triggers and stresses, you even have a higher propensity for people to resort to violence or to use violence as the first option.
Why does violence really show up in the home? You know, it's one thing to be talking about violence at the tavern in a public space, but it seems as though the home is not a sanctuary for many South Africans. Why?
Right. You know, we've done quite a lot of research on, you know, gender-based violence, and particularly looking at, you know, what happens in the home. And it's interesting because there are various reasons, right? We see that gender-based violence is obviously not unique to South Africa, and, you know, in places where it's quite prominent, we see the commonalities around, you know, the status of women, right? The social status of women, the inability to negotiate the different positions of power, and not to sort of homogenize, right, women as, you know, the victims and men as the perpetrators, but where there is a power imbalance and where there's a lack of support in terms of navigating conflict, we see that those power dynamics really become aggravated. And that's where we see that, you know, people tend to utilize that to resort to violence as the, you know, the way to sort of subdue the other person.
So I'm hearing you say violence has a structural component to it. There's always somebody more powerful and somebody less. And in an economy where women earn less, have fewer opportunities, and then they find themselves as partners in a relationship already, that creates the conditions for some sort of abuse. Can it also be true in the reverse?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, what you mentioned earlier about, you know, the essentialization of the G in GBV as women, right, or the equating of the of gender to women is quite dangerous, because we do have, you know, men who are victims of GBV, because it's the power dynamic that is the problematic sort of component, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen in our work quite a number of men who are coming forward and saying this normalization or this essentialization is quite harmful to them, because they can't come forward. They can't come forward in the community. They can't come forward to, you know, police. And it makes it harder for them to reach the kind of mental support that, you know, that men need to sort of to be invited to the table, right? And so it's really unfortunate that there are so many complexities when it comes to identity and power. And so gender really does play a large role, where, you know, you've got men also on the other end as well.
So this is really about power. Violence has a lot to do with who has the power to wield it over another. Is violence, domestic violence, always violent in that we are fighting, or can violence show up in other ways, Gugulethu?
So that's quite interesting, right? We tend to think of violence in very sort of literal and explicit terms. I think for a long time people view violence as, well, were you hit? Were you physically harmed by this person? And I think increasingly we're expanding our notions and our understandings of violence, in that it is, you know, the threat of harm. It is the enactment of harm. And harm can be psychological. Harm can be financial, where somebody's freedom is restricted, where somebody's power and agency is restricted. So I think if we look at, you know, harm and violence in those terms, in terms of limiting somebody's agency and autonomy and freedom and safety, there's so many ways that we can make people feel unsafe. Okay. And there's in turn so many ways that violence and violent behavior can show up.
Okay. Yeah. And finally, what are three suggestions on conflict resolution? Stop yourself from throwing that punch.
I think, you know, when we look at conflict resolution, the one thing is to look at, you know, the de-escalation methods that we have, to think about what kind of de-escalation methods do we have in our arsenal. I think when people are genuinely looking internally at what is another way for me to defuse the situation. Communication, you know, people are capable of negotiating and hearing other people's perspective, and we don't give them a lot of credit for that. I think we give violence too much power in, you know, the sense that we think violence is the only language that people understand. And I think that's a huge disservice to our humanity, to our dignity, and to our just collective ability to work together.
Okay.
So I think in recognizing that humanity in people, and that, you know, there's ability to talk and to hear and see the other person. So I think that's definitely something I would put forward.
Thank you, Kukuletu Khesha, researcher with the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation. De-escalate a situation, diffuse it, walk away, and then ultimately talk about it. Use your words, because actually, in calm, people are in a position to hear you.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.